My name is Tommy Dietrich. I'm from a band called Sky Parade, and I have with me our tour manager, Ed Scott.
Is Ed gonna
you don't have to speak.
Is Ed gonna?
He's just here for moral support.
If there is indeed,
he lives here, and I live down in L.A. So,
but if there is a reason for him to speak, you know, if something comes up in the interview and like
if there's anything to do with tequila, he'll be speaking.
If he wriggles his nose, for example, you know. Or, you know, does something kind of like...
He's basically... Ed is our tour manager slash tequila advisor.
Tequila advisor. Yeah. You know, you need a TA.
Yeah, it's exactly.
So he's your TA. He's your TNA advisor.
This guy put up with us on the road in Europe, or in the UK for how many weeks?
Like 3 weeks.
3 weeks on the
Thank
road.
Thank you. That's a talking point. Remind me about that. See, I knew I'd come up with some questions.
Yeah.
The story is that a promo person we both know... Mm-hmm. Who you obviously brought in, sent me this album, we will describe it as an album, and said, this is you. What's really interesting is we are doing this interview, it'll run a couple of weeks hence, but we're doing this interview on the eve of a very interesting show at the Hemlock, and that is because the bands, at least the two bands, the headliner and the middle band, have
the support,
have a lineage, and we might as well go down that road early so we can do the debauchery and all of that.
Oh,
and
sure.
Then we'll get to you.
That's
and
fun stuff.
So let's go through the lineage a little bit of the mix of that lineup tonight.
Well, so tonight we have the Dilettantes, which is a local San Francisco band, with Joel Guion, whom I met as a teenager I was probably 15 years old. I met Joel in San Francisco. Back when the notorious Brian Jonestown Massacre was just forming, and some of my earliest memories, I think, were basically seeing Joel bang the tambourine and jump up and down on stage, saying things I couldn't repeat on air, but it was good times. So Joel's like a brother, and it's really fun to be back in San Francisco and playing with him. Tonight, I mean, it's like I was thinking about this on the way up. The last time I did any radio was in my band called Your Precious You when I was a teenager, and that was at San Francisco State. That was 15 years ago.
So is this the first time that you've played with Joel?
No,
in terms of backup act?
I've toured with Joel in Jonestown when I played
in
bass.
Jonestown,
yeah,
I've
done tours with him.
Oh, no, but the Dilettantes, it's the first time.
This is the first time with the Dilettantes that our bands have played. I think it's the first time our bands have played together. I think it is, yeah.
And that's pretty cool because the two bands are beginning to take off at a similar trajectory.
We both hit the FMQB singles charts the same week, and we were both tied for... We hit it number 5 the first week, and then we were tied for number 10 for a while.
Now, for those in my audience, even though I report to the FMQB, for those of them who think, you know, in the audience, who think that the FMQB is
a station. People think it's a station.
Either a station or where you go to get your passport.
Right.
That would be the Friday Morning Quarterback, which is a very influential, it's an interesting
thing. Tastemakers.
Let's just, tell me, we'll do only one of these. Tell me the pivotal Brian Jonestown Massacre moment when you knew two things.
Okay.
One, you really wanted to be in the band and why, and number two, why you really had to get the hell out of that band as fast as possible and why.
Okay.
I think I know the second one.
Yeah,
but just...
I mean, I actually never wanted to be in the band, really. I've known those guys. I grew up with those guys. All the original members are some of my best friends to this date. And you know, when I started playing shows, like at the Peacock Lounge in 1992 as a 15-year-old, it was shows with them. And it was like Brave New World and The Nightbreak, which is now Amoeba Records. All these things changed over the years. And it's kind of funny, but the first time I was asked to join the band was 1996. I think that was around the time that I think Peter Hayes joined the band, and I turned him down because I was in college. And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to be playing music for a few years. I basically, for my late teens, I was playing music, and I stopped. And then I ended up moving to San Francisco after I went to UC Santa Cruz and kind of re-met up with all these people that I knew. And it was around that time I moved to Los Angeles, and then I joined Jonestown in 2000 after the TVT kind of deal had kind of fallen through and band had fallen apart again. I'd been out of touch with those guys, with Anton, for years, and I ran into them in L.A. I was playing in a really great band called Small Stone on Bomb Records. And
great label.
Yeah, great label, great band. And, you know, they asked me to, Anton asked me to step in and play because we were going to go on tour together, Small Stone and Jonestown. So I did a tour with them, and that was one that Joel was on, which was really fun. I can tell you a million stories about that. I mean, those were the kind of nights where we're playing 3-hour shows and Joel brings the, you know, two cases of beer on stage and people are buying us shots and we're in Ohio playing for 300 people, you know, having a good time. But, you know, I didn't play with them for a while. I actually quit to play with, to stay focused on Small Stone. And I couldn't come back until 2003. So there was a 3-year period where I didn't really have anything to do.
Not that anything had really changed with the leadership of that band.
No, nothing, you know, and the band has always been him. It's always been Anton and it's always been who he can, you know, the funniest thing is, and probably other people, if you've ever talked to them about the inner circle of the band, is that all of us know each other. All 40 ex-members are
is
all...
Is it 40? I was telling somebody at lunch...
Some people would say as many as 60. I don't know if that's true.
That's what I was going to say.
I don't know if that's true.
If you're going to bet in Vegas mm-hmm. on it, I think the going...
Well, I'll tell you this. I was bass player number 5, I think. So
and so if you multiply the amount of instruments in a band and you take the coefficient
yeah.
and carry the 1...
It's something like that.
It's 3,942,000 refugees
from
BJM.
Yeah, it's very high. But you know, so I played with them and, you know, had these really good opportunities to do some touring and tour, you know, in Europe and tour all over America with them. And I had a great time, but ultimately it wasn't for me because at the end of the day, it's just hard to put up with personalities that are that intense, you know. And so we got in a little scuffle one night and... The story that I've actually never told in public is basically that, you know, one night after a show in Chicago, after being on the road for 8 weeks.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah, no. This is also before Dig, you know, it hit. After I quit, I remember I had some friends, some people, some writers and down in L.A., like with the, I think it was either the Times or there was a couple of magazines that called me. They wanted to know why I left and I just didn't want to validate the... This is 4 years ago now, so it's not a big deal. But yeah, so one night after a show in Chicago, we'd been on the road for 8 weeks. We'd had maybe one day off. We'd played something like 65 shows straight, and everything was going good. But, with the drinking and the just the kind of onstage antics. And the one thing that everybody thinks who joins this band and everybody who knows them, including myself, you always think you're immune to the punishment. Everybody, you'll always hear somebody say, oh, but I can handle him. And the truth is, no one can. No one can, and that's the truth. And so I actually had that thought, too, because I've known him for so many years, and I thought playing with him that it'd be fine. But one night, basically, after a show, he just flipped out on me, and he threw a cup of coffee in my face and in the van, in the tour van, on our way, you know, to Minneapolis. And this was after 8 weeks, and I was getting really tired. So I basically flew home and didn't tell anybody. I got to Minneapolis, played the show, got paid for the tour, and I was in a cab and on the way, and I never even bothered to tell Anton.
I think it gets to a point where talent doesn't will out in that particular human being's situation.
Yeah, well, the thing is, music should be fun, right? I mean, ultimately, music should be fun.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Music should be fun, and I think it's okay that some of the guys can put up with the abuse, but, I mean, I'm a songwriter too, so it's like, for me, it didn't make sense to continue... And the only thing that's great about the band is that they play larger shows, they get to travel a lot more to all these countries, you know, and that's exciting. But the reality is, at what cost?
Did you have a concept in mind with the history of the bands that you had been in? Did you turn around and
how
say...
How did that influence, you
did
think?
Did you say, well, more so, did you say, okay, I want to form this new band and here's what I want to do. And this is now going to be my chance... You know, to do something new. How did you conjure up Sky Parade?
Well, for one thing, it took me, I guess, in reasonable terms, a little while to get there because I've been playing in bands since, you know, like I said, since I was 15 years old, and it wasn't until I was 25 that I really started writing my own songs and doing this and I kind of after the experiences I had, and I always kind of was this person who wrote songs but never had, you know, made the band. And 3 years ago, I decided after, you know, a little over 3 years ago, after I stopped playing and, you know, I stopped playing with Small Stone and I was playing with Jonestown again, I stopped doing that. And then I decided, you know, I'm just going to make a record. And so what I did was I started recording. I produce and engineer recordings in LA. I have my own project studio. It's not like it's some crazy big studio, but I started working on recordings and I started bringing people in. I didn't have a band at all.
So I wrote, it was really kind of a solo project. That
it was a solo project
that morphed. Morphed into a band.
For example, like the song "Losing Control" off our first record. That was a riff that I'd come up with, and I started writing. And basically, I had Jason, my friend from the Warlocks, came in, and he laid down the drums. And then it was like, okay, well, my brother was in town; he recorded the bass. And then I finally convinced my friend Matt Lindgren he moved back from Spain, and you know, we're best friends, and he's a great guitar player, kind of like one of these guys that, you know, spent 10 years in his bedroom becoming the perfect guitar player. Well, I mean, hello, it's like you want to, you know, get the turnip while it's ripe. And, you know, I grabbed him and made him, he was going to move back here because, you know, I used to live here too.
Right.
And he was going to move to San Francisco. And I said, you know what, why don't you stay in LA and play music with me? So the next thing I knew, he was writing these great riffs and for Losing Control. And next, after 4 or 5 months of this, bringing in people, we had a record. And then once we had the record, I found that the people who played on it, the majority of it, decided, well, let's make this a band. That was how it started.
Well, that's sometimes that's the best way, because otherwise you can do it the other
way. I was going to do it no matter what. I was going to make this record no matter what, whether anybody listened to it or it got played on the radio or anything. And so I did it. And then once everybody heard it at the end, they wanted to play, and I was ecstatic. It was perfect, you know.
Now, what's interesting is that you're, and I've been through this a lot recently, because there's been a lot of LA-based bands. Not that LA-based, but we'll call it an LA band.
But I'm a Northern California kid, trust me.
Well, yeah, and that's what's interesting is...
I've kept that.
But what's fabulous is, and I can name them, Seawolf, Airborne Toxic Event. I'm trying to think of other ones that have very recently been where you're sitting. Okay. And they're all saying the same thing, which is kind of neat, is that LA really is not LA anymore.
No, it's not.
It's more like New York. It's more like New York, because there's Silver Lake, and then there's, you know, West LA, and each of these little components.
There's Silver Lake, there's Hollywood, there's West LA.
Yeah,
there's,
and they're all developing sounds. Mm-hmm. It's almost like New York in that, you know, doo-wop came out of a certain, you know, came out of the Bronx, and then punk pretty much came out of Manhattan.
I always say it's the best kept secret, which makes no sense, because we're in the city where the industry was born and died. It's pretty much dead now. I mean, you know, it's really crazy to me that the model took so long to change that you know, a band like the Silver Sun Pickups, who blew up, came from my hometown. You know, we're acquaintances, friends, whatever. Don't know them very well, but like they're, you know, they were able to come out of this. But there's a million of those bands. There's my band. There's other bands. There's all these bands that have been sitting there bubbling up. And while the model and the taste changed over time in the last 15 years, for some reason the industry didn't really catch up. And I mean, I understand that there's always going to be a default setting for the, you know, the Beyonce and the, you know, whatever the big pop phenomenon
the
is.
The thing of the moment.
Which is fine. But I think that it's a shame when there's all these great artists that are under the belly of the beast and they don't get recognized.
And so you recorded this. You had the first album. You had this piece. What did you do from there? You said, okay, I've got this. And you didn't do the typical thing, which is, okay, I'm going to shop this to labels.
No, I we've been fiercely DIY, as I say it. What happened was, we ended up doing a thing early on where, you know, we had a buzz. People heard our stuff. KCRW was playing it. Indie 103 was playing some of the songs. And was cool. So all of a sudden, you know, a lot of indie labels kind of start approaching us, and it's like, well, what can you do? Well, not really anything. So
right, what can you really?
What
put
can you really
us?
Do? And what I was seeing on these papers was like, oh, and we retain 30% of this, and I just saw a bunch of numbers, and I was like, you know what? Why do I need a bunch of percentage points and documents in front of me when all I got to do is basically get it on iTunes, get it out to digital distribution? People don't really sell a large volume of records anymore anyway, so I can print up 1,000 and start with that. You know, we sold a few thousand records as an independent band with nothing, with no one, with absolutely nothing behind us. And I'm proud of that. And we produced and recorded our records, which I'm proud of too. But it's, you know, it was a decision I made, because we did sign with a small label in LA and they released an EP, but they didn't do anything with it. They were kind of, their stance was kind of, okay, we've got a piece of you now, and we want a major label to pick you up so we can get another piece. And I realized, wow, what a mistake that was. So we put out Fire in the Sky as an independent album, and then bam, it's like we ended up touring in the UK and going over really well. It started getting played on the radio. I mean, obviously it's not in rapid rotation. It is on programs like yours, and it's like, you know, it's not going to be you know, it's hard for everybody to get any kind of radio play, but the fact that it did really made me feel like, all right, well, I'm doing something right.
So tell me a little bit about the UK, because, you know, wow, you're getting played more in the UK than you are in the United States.
Sure. Well, and I think that, well, I think we, you know, I don't know if that's totally true, but I think that I know from our experience of touring over there that we sold a lot of records and a lot of, you know, just things like t-shirts and posters. And, you know, over here on tour, or just, you know, it's, you have that exotic thing, and sure, I think that's great, but it's just the taste is different. And I think we've always had a little bit of a, I don't want to, you know, give away since we're not talking about the style of music, but we have had a British kind of, you know, I mean, I always think back to great 60s bands. I think of, you know, Pink Floyd, or I think of anything from the Kinks to, I think Rubber Soul taught me to play bass. You know,
right.
I look at those albums and I look at, you know, I don't think we sound like any one of those things, but we draw from that, you know, we draw from this grassroots,
which makes it a
psychedelic
natural,
you know, influences, or whatever you want to call it. You know, so, you know, people think like, oh, you made some Beatlesque happy love album. It's like, no, this is a psychedelic rock album ish thing, indie, alternative, whatever you want to call it. But yeah, I think it's just it's what it is. It was, that's where I was, and I'm glad to have made that, and now we're gonna get back to rocking a little harder, I think. Like, you know.
So speaking of rocking a little harder, here's what we do on the influences question.
All right.
We've invented a little thing called a musical sandwich. And here's how we play the game. The musical sandwich, we pick two Sky Parade songs as the bread.
Okay.
And then we pick anything by other artists in between.
Let's do I Feel Surreal and oh, that's a tough one. Love Is Forever or Lullaby Love. I'm going to do Love Is Forever because I think that song is
it's rolling.
Is
in, it's been that, rolling in my head for the past.
It's one that I think, I don't know why this is. Everybody's playing I Feel Surreal, which I'm so excited about it. I think it's, but I'm surprised because I feel like if I was the disc jockey, for some reason I'd pick Love Is Forever.